This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about Christmas and the festive period as a factor in mental health. This is a theme we covered for the first time last year, and I'm really glad to be covering it again from a different perspective with two new brilliant and inspiring guests. Also, before we go on, we just wanted to wish everyone a happy Christmas from
Merry Christmas.
From the team here at Mental. We understand that this episode is coming out on the 26th of December, but all the same, we hope you had a brilliant day if you celebrate it, and that you have a fun break and get some rest before the new year kicks off. With that said, we'll get into some stats, and Danielle, I think you're going to get us started.
I am, yes. Mind. We found some research for Mind that talks about that 1 in 10 people feel unable to cope at Christmas, which I'm not surprised about, but that rises to a third of people with a mental health problem.
Right. It's sort of not surprising, but it is a really good stat for showing the difference between how Christmas can be an intense time for all of us, but if you've already got an existing mental illness, it just makes that so much more likely that you're going to find this time of year difficult.
Yeah, and to be honest, you know, I've been so busy and running around and doing everything. But, you know, when you really stop, I've checked in a few times with friends and people that I know struggle at this time of year. And, yeah, it does really remind you how difficult, for so many reasons, Christmas can be for people. And actually, the second stat that says over a quarter of people feel the pressure to have a perfect Christmas. In fact, I thought that it would be more than that.
Yeah, me too.
Population, everybody that you talk to seems to feel the pressure, but that increases to half of those with a mental health problem.
Well, maybe it's a case that not everyone feels the pressure to have a perfect Christmas, but I think we all feel pressure around this time of year. You know, there's something we're trying to get right. Even if, you know, we don't celebrate it, there's probably still work dues or gifts and cards and stuff that are going back and forth, maybe a secret Santa you're part of. I think there is more pressure, and I think you had some general information on that as well.
I did, yes. Or at least we can pause. I've come out of the page. I found some further information from NetDoctor that talked about whether you live with a mental illness or not, the festive period can intensify feelings of loneliness, increase financial worries, and put pressure on people to have the perfect Christmas.
Right, so that's really confirmed, I think, in those statistics we had earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. And they talk about the fact that it's overwhelming and that this need to have this perfect Christmas and getting into debt causes, you know, increased strain and stress. And also that, you know, people tend to overindulge and drink more alcohol, which can worsen mental health symptoms, while over-exerting ourselves socially, and that can leave them tired and anxious. So a lot of those triggers that we already know are common for people who are struggling with mental illness at Christmas. This information just shows that, you know, it literally triples. The pressure increases so much in all of those areas.
And that's one of the reasons why I'm so glad to cover this theme, but also why when we did it the first time, this time last year, it was actually really difficult, because when you speak to people, it can be quite difficult to cohesively say why Christmas can be so difficult for people. That for so many people, it's a brilliant and exciting time of year. And there's not just sort of one reason, it's actually loads of contributing factors that all come together to make it a challenging time of year for a lot of people. You know, that's not to say it can't be a wonderful time, but I think there is that increased pressure across the board. And we mentioned that some of those stats, particularly the one about pressure to have a perfect Christmas, seems a bit low to us. I've got another stat from Mind. In a 2015 poll, they found that 76% of people had problems sleeping at Christmas. So to me, that's a clear example of maybe at times we don't always realise how much pressure we can be under this time of year, but it can come out in our sleep. And that is a really high percentage, 76%, because that's people, wow, in general. That's not even just those experiencing mental illness.
Absolutely, that's a huge statistic. And I think I'd like to say as well at that point, this point, that for our listeners, and even for us, and to myself, you know, people often talk about that years ago, Christmas was a time when everything shut down, you couldn't go to a shop, there was nothing, you know, you should have, it was better that got all your stuff in because nothing was open, and spent all your time with your family and presents and food and eating. And actually, thinking about now in today's society, the fact that, one, it's so much more diverse in our society, so there's a lot of people that aren't celebrating Christmas. And I just think that actually that pressure can be removed if you, because you don't have to buy into it. You don't have to feel that pressure to do the things, you know, the Christmas, the presents, the eating, the spending time with family. There's actually, you can actually pull yourself away from it and not, if it's something that might affect you. I kind of just wanted to say that, you know, for listeners, even going into the new year, a lot of people find it hard. It's a new year. What have I done this year? Oh, my God, I haven't reached my goals. Or, you know, we know people that don't like New Year's Eve. I just think that, again, if we remove that pressure that it's something that we have to do because the nation's doing it, or because, actually, no, if it's not going to make you well, I've got an auntie that completely steps aside from it. It's not a great time of year for her. She owns that. She steps away from it. Doesn't buy presents. Doesn't come and have Christmas dinner with us. Quite happy to just let the day go. And when people say to her, oh, it must be so sad, or you're on your own, or this, she said, no, absolutely not. I'm absolutely happy doing it this way. And it's not through not celebrating Christmas. It's just that she knows the pressure doesn't do well for her mental illness. And I've, in the last few years, really come to admire that about her. I think, you know, just a little note for everybody to think about that.
Right. I think that's a really fair approach. And it's very true. I think, for example, whether you celebrate Christmas from a religious point of view or not, either way, it's a time for celebration. And that doesn't necessarily mean getting the most lavish gifts and putting yourself under that kind of stress to get everything perfect. You know, when I look back at Christmases, I can't tell you half the gifts I've got, but I can tell you the times I had with family.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that really matters. You know, that's what I think this time of year should be all about, because otherwise you can get kind of caught up. You can get so caught up in the planning that you actually get to the day itself and you're all exhausted. And, you know, and then you're not really getting the quality time that you're supposedly planning for.
I've got bags at the moment hanging off my chin. Like, I'm already like, oh, I'm so tired. You know, we've got 4 days to go and I'm going away. So I'm grateful for that. But, yeah, absolutely shattered. It doesn't help.
Yeah. But to lead into today's interview, that is one of the privileges we have compared to some people, that we can spend time with family. Not everyone has family around or family that they're close to that they can spend time with. And we talked a little bit about that in last year's episode on this theme. If you want to listen to that around the same time, I'd really recommend it. And the two guests in that one talked about how they now spend Christmas together because they found that's far more protective of their mental health than it would be to spend it with family, with some of the history they've had there. In the same way as your aunt, that's quite a mature approach. It's not easy to make a decision like that. And I can imagine they equally have a lot of outsiders questioning them on that. But sometimes you have to engage in the self-care and prioritise your own well-being to not get iller.
Well said, Bobby. With it. Engage in self-care and prioritise your own.
Absolutely. And by contrast with today's guests, they've started a charity called Deck the Wards. So this conveniently links a little bit to last week's episode, because what their organisation does is goes around mental health secure wards and they distribute gifts in the form of like gift boxes to help people that are in hospital over Christmas feel that they're less alone and feel like they can still celebrate Christmas. And in the episode, they'll talk all about the different kind of gifts they include and how they support the kind of community feeling on the wards, how they can make people feel less lonely and isolated from family. And also, they're really fascinating because they talk about the experience of sectioning from both sides, that one of them has been through that experience and the other one has witnessed it. And so they can see how you can feel kind of lonely and really miss significant people in your life, whether you're on the inside of that hospital or outside and missing them. So it is a really important topic, and I think it's also a really clear example of how there's still a lot of work to be done on parity of care, because this is something that we were instantly in love with when we found out about their work, but we'd never really thought about before. And on speaking to the guests, Katie talks about working in physical health charities. There are similar provisions, but she really struggled to find anything like it for mental health. And I can't help but be suspicious there's a lot of stigma responsible for that. If anything, I think you might be able to argue that Christmas, based on the stats and the research we've done, is an even more challenging time in hospital when it's to do with your mental health and your physical health. They're both incredibly difficult, but things like struggling to sleep, things like anxiety around the perfect Christmas, the pressure of wanting everything to be right and wanting to have a good time with family, you know, that is all going to be exacerbated by mental illness. Do you think that's fair?
I'm sitting here thinking about how much work actually could be done, and even from a, you know, an active, from a charity point of view, is to giving gifts and going around supporting people on the wards of mental health hospitals, but also the support, the emotional support, and talking to people. And I was thinking, even with us doing this episode, we should be doing this episode at like the end of November, Bob, next year. We're doing it, give people some, you know, some, as they go into that whole December. You know, it's a lot of pressure, but it doesn't have to be. And I think, thinking about what you're saying about the charity that we interview next, it's absolutely amazing work. And it, at least it started. But actually, yeah, it has made me think about, wow, if it wasn't for them, who else is doing this?
Right, absolutely. It, to me, is really inspirational, the work they did. And so it's serious as the need is, and as challenging as this time of year can be for so many people, it is heartwarming to see people out there making a difference to the lives of those they don't even know. And I think that really comes across the altruism and the warmth of these two guests as the interview progresses. So we'll get into that shortly. On the theme of gifts, I feel like we should mention our live podcast recording as well. With this being a challenging time of year, I know for me, it's not so much Christmas as it is New Year is the one I find really difficult. I tend to find it's the one time of year where depression can really overtake me, and I can find it difficult not to focus on all the things I've not achieved in the year, you know, all the aims that I'm having to pause or maybe achieve next year instead. I can find that a really low time for me, and it has been for a long time, really. It's sort of become, in a way, almost like a strange ritual that it's the one time of year I allow myself to feel that way and know that sometimes it, you know, it is okay, that no matter who you are, no matter what position you're in, even if you do a mental health podcast, sometimes you do struggle, and that's okay. And this is one time of year where I kind of know it's coming, and I do get extra support, and it's a few days, and then I can generally pull myself out of it and be excited for the new year once it's begun. But there can be a certain sort of dread I find around the whole countdown. That's the passage of time is not exciting to me in the way that it is for some people. So one thing that is really great about this year is that we've got the wonderful live show to look forward to. And the plan for that is that it'll be monthly. So this will take mental and the way we can connect with people to a whole new level next year. And that's incredibly heartwarming. So if you do want to get yourself an early New Year's gift and invest in having more mental health conversations in 2020, weird to say that year, it doesn't hardly sound real. But if you want to make that investment in yourself and showing up for mental health, speaking about it more, then definitely come along to our live recording. And you can get tickets now at mentalpodcast.co.uk/live. That link is also in the episode description. I'd really encourage you to come along to that and it should be a lot of fun. It should be a really great thing to look forward to. And I know we're incredibly excited about it.
It's going to come around really quickly. I'm already thinking to myself, wow, it's like as soon as it's the new year, it's like 5 weeks.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's why I thought we definitely need to talk about it now, whilst people hopefully have their Christmas money coming in potentially, or, you know, have these few quieter days that can come between Christmas and New Year's. Annie, my previous co-host, used to call it the dead days, because she just said it was so weird that time. You sort of don't know what day of the week it is or if you're coming or going.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like Saturday feels like Tuesday.
It's very strange. And particularly with Christmas being on a Wednesday this year, it doesn't feel right. I know that's how the calendar works, but it does feel strange that it's midweek. And I know for a lot of people, they're only breaking up for Christmas the Friday before, so it's only going to add to that rush. Yeah, but that's really why I wanted to make sure to mention their live show as well, just because it will come around so quick. We're going to be majorly pushing it in January, and so it's impossible for us to say how long there'll still be tickets around. So we'd love to see as many of you there as possible. With that all said, we'll get into this uplifting, insightful, much needed episode with our guests Jasmine and Katie in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name's Katie, I'm the co-founder of Deck the Wards, and my sort of early mental health memories are of becoming unwell when I was a teenager. So a lot of that, I know there were a couple of people that found school very stressful and very difficult, and I was one of them. And I associate a lot of my early mental health memories around bullying and struggling a lot with depression. I was sent to hospital a few times in my teens, where I was diagnosed with bipolar after having a manic episode. So lots of my early mental health memories are tied up with school and difficulties at school and struggling with the pressures of school, struggling with bullying, dealing with sort of self-harm, dealing with suicidal feelings. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's probably my earliest sort of mental health memories and realizing that mental health was even a thing at all. And it was much less talked about when I was younger, much less talked about. And that's, you know, sort of 14 years ago. It's really different now. I think not perfect, but much, much different now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree. And that's interesting that you were diagnosed after a manic episode. I think that's less common than being diagnosed with bipolar after a depressive episode.
Yeah. So I originally was diagnosed with depression when I was 14. I was hospitalized, I was sectioned. And in some ways that looked a little bit more clear cut. It was when discharged from hospital, in the summer after I'd been admitted, I started displaying these manic symptoms. And I think a lot of people don't know what mania is. So it mm-hmm. was lack of sleep, lack of inhibition, massive excess energy. I would talk really, really quickly. Everyone, my ideas would be really, you wouldn't be able to follow what I was saying. Right. I'd be making really unsafe decisions. So I'd be walking to the street because I thought I was a god and that traffic would just pass through me. I thought I could fly. I was really, really unwell, and I was sectioned again, and they don't often diagnose bipolar in younger people, but it was so clear cut manic episode that they were like, nope, this is bipolar, this is mania. And so I was diagnosed quite quickly when I was sectioned that time in hospital.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And at the time when you were first sectioned, do you remember how you felt about that experience?
I think when I was sectioned, when I was manic, I was just so frustrated because in my mind, I'd been depressed all this time. And I was like, but I'm happy and I'm fine. Mm. I don't understand why you're making me be in hospital. And I was so frustrated and so annoyed. I used to sort of absolutely lose. You have a really bad temper when you're manic as well. Really, really irritable. Really, I get really big outbursts of anger. And but so many of them would be like, this is so unfair. What are you doing? Like, this is not right. I'm fine. I'm completely fine. And just being so outraged and feeling so much like your voice is lost because you are unwell. And so you're saying those really unwell things. And everyone has to protect, you know, your safety, be like, that's not true. That's not the case. But so you're feeling very like voiceless and frustrated mm-hmm. and angry, and like I didn't know where to put those feelings because no one believed what I was saying.
Right. And that is, I think, one of the reasons why manic periods can be so misunderstood, because you've got these very real delusions to you, and yet they don't relate to the world or anyone else's experience.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was so convinced, you know, I remember going and dancing on the, we're from London, and there are some bridges over the Thames, and I went and danced on the bridge over the river, and like right up on the side, which was really dangerous, really dangerous. And people would come up to me and be like, "Don't jump, don't jump." And I'd be like, "What are you talking about? Of course I'm not going to jump. I'm just dancing," and sort of be really, really carried away and overexcited. But in my mind, I was like, "Of course I'm safe. I'm completely fine." Whereas obviously the members of the public are going, "Oh my gosh, this young woman's going to fall off. This young woman's going to hurt herself." And so it is that weird thing of, I completely believed it, but no one else did. And that's so frustrating and annoying, because the whole rest of the world feels like it's wrong to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be very scary for you, having that experience of people kind of invalidating what you think is true, but also very scary for those around you.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's scary in a different way to that sort of suicidal feelings when you're depressed, because your risk is just a different type of risk. It's still a risk to yourself, and sometimes a risk to others, but mostly a risk to yourself and the dangerous situations you put yourself in. And lots of people sort of associate mania with being fun, and I always say hypomania in some ways is fun, which sometimes it can feel quite joyous, but mania is just terrifying, because the whole world is so out of, for me anyway, the whole world is so out of control and so just completely chaotic, and nothing makes sense and no one makes sense, and you can't communicate with everyone because everyone's so slow, and no one gets it. No one believes what you believe in. No one understands what you're saying. Just no one can keep up. And that's really hard. And then obviously for your family, they're seeing you do these dangerous, scary things that don't make sense. And they can't reach you. They can't reason with you or contact you properly, or, you know, have any sort of way of getting through to you. So you're so separate. You're such separate entities, yourself and your loved ones, when you're unwell. It can be really scary.
I love that way of phrasing it, actually, separate entities. I think that's so accurate, that the way mental illness can create such distance from the people you care about the most.
Yeah, it definitely can, because what you're going through is so alien to people who haven't been through it. And when I've been depressed or when I've been manic, trying to reach out to people is really hard. And they want to reach out to you so often. They want to be able to connect with you, but your experiences are just so different and so just so hard to understand. And I struggle to understand myself when I get better. I struggle to understand what I was like when I was unwell and who I was when I was unwell. So, and I experienced it. So expecting your loved ones to be able to understand that too, it's such a big ask. But it obviously means that both sides feel really isolated and cut off from that person. I know that's something that Jazz could obviously talk about as well. I think you could definitely feel that isolation and that far awayness.
Yeah, I'm Jazz. I'm one of the other co-founders and trustees of Deck the Wards. And my experience of mental health is a little bit different to Katie's in that I was always aware of mental health, I think. And we met in 2014. And when we met, the press was starting to talk about mental health a bit more. So there was an awareness that I had of mental health, I think, and what it was. But I didn't have any real idea of what it looked like and what that actually meant for someone who was unwell. And so when we first met, and it was the first time I'd ever met anyone who had been sectioned and especially sectioned as a child or a teenager, and Katie would tell me these stories of what hospital was like. And I think when you don't understand that sort of thing, when you've not really seen it before or heard about it or seen depictions, accurate depictions, you're kind of reliant on what you see in TV and film, which often is a very inaccurate, sensationalist, unbalanced portrayal.
Right.
A bit less now, but a bit more then. And so when I met Katie, that's kind of how I got a better understanding. And then we're a couple, and so when Katie has, over the last few years, been kind of learning more about mental health, what Katie's talking about in terms of that separateness can be quite difficult. We kind of have to communicate very well to make sure that we understand, I understand what Katie's going through, And in particular with mania, that can be quite difficult because I think you are articulating yourself very well and you know exactly what you're talking about. But from my perspective, you're very quick and I can't quite keep up with your train of thought. So I think that can be something that we've both learned to navigate, really.
Right. And for many mental illnesses, that can be a symptom that you don't want to communicate as much or it's more difficult to.
Yeah, I think that certainly can be for how it manifests for you.
Yeah, I think not wanting to communicate or not knowing how to communicate as well, not knowing how to articulate what you're going through is really difficult. And in itself, obviously, it's so isolating because sometimes I feel like the people I want to be able to help me, I just don't know how to tell them how I'm feeling, or I don't know what to say, or I'm so ashamed and embarrassed and I don't know how to reach out and say, actually, I need help, or I'm scared, or I can't do these things, and because I feel like I'm letting people down. Or sometimes I just don't realise I need to communicate. I don't realise I need to tell people because I'm so confined in the world of being unwell that I don't put together that this is something I need to extend out an arm and link back to the real world, link back to people around me. And I know that puts people like Jazz in a really difficult position because she often has to guess how I'm feeling.
Well, I think it sometimes we'll have a conversation and Kate say, oh, yeah, you know, like we spoke about. And I think, oh, I don't think we have. And, you know, so that's very difficult because I don't want to make Katie feel that she has in any way let me down or has done anything wrong because, of course, she hasn't. So basically then we just have to kind of navigate and move into this new way of being where there's an understanding that sometimes Katie may say, oh, you know, we've spoken about this already and we haven't, and those sorts of things become our new normal for that period of time. It's just a different way of relating to one another and others as well, our friends and family too.
Right. And to continue the theme of talking about isolation, how did you find that when being sectioned and being confined to wards in the past, Katie?
It's really isolating because the rest of the world isn't like you, and being sectioned is something that's so, you're so deprived of all these rights that you take for granted, being able to nip to the shops when you want to, being able to just make your own decisions. You're suddenly in this alien environment in hospital and people come and shine a light on you every 15 minutes to check if you're asleep or just to check how you're doing, to check that you're still alive. And that's really just so alienating. And when you're sectioned and you have to rely on other people to make choices for you, you can have stuff like you can have medication forced on you when you don't want to take it. And it's such a scary and just it can be just such a horrible experience. And you can feel betrayed by the people who you love, because they've often, you know, in your mind, sort of gone along with it and agreed with it. And you're thinking, well, what's wrong with you? Why are you leaving me here? Why are you making me stay here when I don't want to be here? It's really isolating.
Right. And I imagine as a young person, not knowing much about that environment going into it, it can feel a bit like being imprisoned, like that you've done something wrong to be there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I had, before I was in hospital, when I first was going to hospital when I was 14, I had all these negative images of hospital. I had really stereotypical, stigmatizing images of hospital. I had the images of people rocking back and forward. I had the images of straight jackets, padded cells, all of that, you know, lightning striking the asylum tower kind of idea, what it was going to be like. And that was my own stigma that I took with me. And I thought, but I'm not like that. That's not me. That's not who I am. And when I got to hospital, it was such a surreal experience because it felt like being imprisoned. It felt like being just cut off from the rest of the world. And how could anyone possibly understand you or understand this situation that you've been in? I think it is a transformative experience because once you've been admitted to a psychiatric hospital, for me, my life was never quite the same because I'd gone through this experience. And in some ways, positive ways, I met some really interesting and amazing people. My stigma was massive. My self-stigma and my stigma was massively, obviously, challenged and overhauled even on the first day, sort of meeting the other people, the other patients that were in the hospital. But it did feel like a prison. There's locked doors. There's the nurses have panic alarms on them. The alarms go off all the time. You have to go to bed at a certain time. You can't have loads of things. They take away your shoelaces even. It's really a horrible experience. And really, when you're sort of 14 and used to getting up, going to school, living your life, chatting to your friends and everything, just completely different and alien.
Right. One other thing I just wanted to pick up that you mentioned there about people checking on you every 15 minutes. If the listeners aren't aware of that, for the people that are under the closest observation of sectioning, often nurses working on the ward will literally have a clipboard and they'll have to check certain patients and write down their location and what they were doing. Was that your experience as well?
There's a few different levels of observations, and one of them will be sort of 15-minute, half-hourly checks where people will come round and will, yeah, check on you, write what you're doing. They'll write what you're wearing sometimes. Even closer than that, there's one-to-one or two-to-one observations where you'll have a person with you literally all of the time. There's no time in the toilet, in the shower. There's no time that there won't be someone with you and watching you. And that is so dehumanising, and it's for your own safety, you know, but one of the ways they describe it is to call it arm's length one-to-one. That means someone's within arm's length of you all the time. So you're having a shower and they have to keep looking at you to make sure you're not doing anything risky. And it just, there's not a lot more dehumanising than that. It makes you feel very vulnerable. But at the same time, you understand, you don't necessarily understand at the time, but, you know, with hindsight, you can understand why they're doing that. But I think people, you'd never imagine, I would never, before going to hospital, have imagined that there'd be people in that situation who are having one, two people with them all the time because their level of risk was so high.
Right. It must be very surreal. And I imagine can really affect your feeling of autonomy. That, you know, on one hand, as part of the recovery, you need to be empowered to feel that you're getting better and you have a certain amount of control over your recovery. But then something like that really close observation, it must really conflict with that.
Yeah, it definitely does, because, yeah, there's an attitude that autonomy obviously is so important when you're trying to get better, but there's situations where they have to take that away, and it's really hard to recover in those scenarios. And even though I can retrospectively understand why I needed to have that level of support, at the same time, it's hard to wrap your head around, because how do you get better when you've got just no privacy, when you've got these people watching you and with you all the time? And it also, when you have people visit, for example, like when Jazz would come to visit me in hospital as an adult, you know, that person's there, and that just ruins any opportunity to have intimacy with a loved one, because you can't just have a private conversation with them.
Yeah, when you sort of seeing your loved one in hospital, you kind of feel like you're being rude to the members of staff almost. So if I was to ask Katie, you know, how her day was, or if Katie was to ask me how are our friends, and then you were to say, oh, you know, I saw Jane or whatever the other day, you kind of then feel like you almost have to turn to the nurse who's there and explain who that is and give them background. So you're almost the way that you're not kind of leaving them out in a strange way. So it just changes the nature of your interactions, and it can be very surreal to have that person around all the time.
Right. I guess I hadn't even thought of that, but because of the proximity of a lot of these staff, you feel the need to include them.
It's strange, because it's not normally in your everyday kind of interactions. You wouldn't be talking to your partner or your friend or your family member with a stranger kind of sat right next to you, but ignoring them. It's a very unusual kind of way of interacting with people. So it's small things like that that you just don't think about until you kind of are faced with it, really.
Right. So in terms of that bringing you up to the work you do now, at what point did you both start to have the idea of Deck the Wards?
So I have this lived experience, and flash forward a few years, was working in a physical health charity, and we got donated so much stuff at Christmas. It was incredible. I've never seen anything like it. Mince pies, selection boxes, gifts, tree decorations, just so much of it that there wasn't room for it in the premises that we had. We had it sort of pouring out of every cupboard, and we were still giving away these selection boxes way later into the year. And I just remembered being in hospital, and I thought, gosh, there was just, when I was in hospital as a young person, there just wasn't anything like that. There was one occasion, and this is across 4 years, there was one occasion where we got donated some Easter eggs, but actually they weren't donated to us. They were donated to the physical health wards, but the physical health wards had too many. They had so many that they'd run out of storage, so they sort of chucked a few down to the mental health ward. And that felt, although we were happy to have an Easter egg, it felt really rubbish. And so myself and Jasmine, we started donating stuff, didn't we, to our local ward. And Jazz would call them up, and what would they say? It would
Well, we decided that, you know, we just wanted to do something local and informal initially. So we thought, wouldn't it be nice just to be able to give some stuff to our local wards? And that being the intention, it's for them, it's because of them, it's because they deserve to have it, rather than it being an afterthought or something, right, you know, less good or whatever. So we called up a local, we were living in Oxford at the time, and we called up a local ward, and they were completely baffled. I think they did not understand what we were trying to do. We sort of said, well, you know, we just want to drop off some stuff. We really thought it would be very easy. We said, we just want to drop off some stuff. You know, what sort of stuff would you like? When can we drop it off? Is that okay? And they really thought that we must be wanting something from them, because otherwise we wouldn't be calling. So they didn't know who we were. Were we a business? Did we want to come on the ward? What were we looking for from them? And they had no understanding of what we were trying to do, because it never happens. They said to us, this doesn't happen. We don't have people calling us up, wanting to give us anything. It just never happens. So it was so alien to them. They just couldn't wrap their head around what we were trying to do.
Wow, that's really sad to hear that they were so surprised by that kind of lovely gesture that they just didn't know what to do with it.
It was incredibly sad, and it's actually something that even now, as a charity, we're quite a young charity, but even now as a charity, when we first contact wards and say, we're a charity, we'd like to, you know, we've got some money for you, we'd like to buy some things to make it easier for young people to be in hospital, it still sometimes can take a good few days or weeks, several phone calls, before they actually understand what it is that we're trying to do, because again, it just doesn't really happen.
No, and that's what sort of led us to think about making what we were doing. So what we did in Oxford was obviously very small scale, very informal, just to our local ward, and it made us think, actually, this is something that needs to be wider spread, this is something we want to take and make bigger. And so we sort of between us had a back and forth about how do we do that, you know, do we deliver to a few more wards ourselves? And then we thought, let's actually set something up, let's set up a provision that can provide these things. In particular, what we focus on is the school holidays, because those are the hardest times to be in hospital. That's what I remember as a young person, just the education groups stop, and all of a sudden you've got these huge expanses of hours and hours just to entertain yourself, because there are a couple of groups still, but just compared to what you're used to, barely any. And you're going through this really difficult time. Your family can only visit you during visiting hours. So you have to entertain yourself for a really long time. And hospitals just don't have money to spend on brand new games, brand new DVDs, brand new things like that, because they just don't. They're obviously spending them on essentials and things that people need. And so you would have, we have this same old game of Uno Extreme that we played it to death. We played it all the time. And you just started being like, okay, whatever. Yes, here I go. I've pressed the machine. It's fired out loads of cards. Oh, okay, brilliant. You just get so bored of it. Yeah, so we wanted to do something that lifted some of that monotony on the wards during the holidays.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And to clarify for the listeners, when you mentioned the education groups, that's when, during what are school term times, you have extra support on the wards to study so you don't fall behind, is that right?
Yeah, so you have some wards have actual little schools attached to them. So you'll go and have, depending on how well you are, it depends person to person, but you will have essentially a quite full school day. Your school at home will often send in work for you to do. They'll have their own groups and education things going on. You'll do a wide range of things like drama, you'll do different arts, you'll do English, you'll do your own, some people will be working on their GCSEs, some people working on their A-levels, and yeah, you'll have these just much busier days, because obviously they don't want you to miss out on too much of your education. So yeah, like I say, some wards have entire schools that you go off the ward, you spend the morning in the school, come back onto the ward, have your lunch, go back to the school for the afternoon, which is, at least it passes. Lots of people don't want to go because they're too unwell, or just the way that they're unwell makes them really feel lack of motivation. But they're just, in lots of ways, they're so valuable to pass the time and to keep you at least in touch with your schoolwork so you don't fall ridiculously behind, which is one thing that when you leave is so hard. You've missed out on all of this stuff that's going on with your peers. And also you've got all this huge pile of schoolwork to catch up on, which is really hard when you're trying to recover.
I mean, as well as the substance of what we do in terms of providing boxes and things, this is also something that we really like as a charity to try and do is just educate a little bit where we can, where the opportunity comes up as to what being in hospital actually looks like and is, because when we first met, I had no idea about the mechanics of that sort of thing. I didn't mm-hmm. know that children and young people would have to kind of keep up with school and hospital, and maybe there would be schools and maybe there would be educational programs. So trying to give that understanding of as hospital is this very simultaneously very alien environment but also very normal environment, sort of these things kind of sit alongside one another, and just trying to educate people about what that looks like is something that we're keen on doing as well.
Right, because when people know that, it's actually very logical. Like, of course, the kids need to keep on top of their schoolwork. Of course, periods where the school classes aren't on, you've got less distraction. You might be missing your normal routine more. Whereas at least when you've got your stand-in school classes, there's a kind of normalising experience within that.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's very, until you know it, you kind of, it seems quite unusual. And then when you hear about that and you think, oh, actually, of course, it's just perfectly normal. And I think when we first met and Katie was telling me about these experiences, I was really struck by, in some ways, the alienness of, for example, having someone with you at all times. But then the normality of some of the stories you tell about, you know, the games you play together and the DVDs you watch together and the times when you, as a teenager, in this really alien environment, could feel like a very normal teenager. And that's why the things that we try and encourage the wards to choose, things like games, DVDs, karaoke machines, they're things that are deliberately designed to bring wards together for those normal moments and create those moments that help you feel a bit more human again, feel like a normal teenager again, maybe give you a bit more fun, just a fun moment with friends. And actually, Katie and we have a third trustee, Hermione, and Katie and Hermione met in hospital 13 years ago. And so those friendships can be forged in hospital that are long-lasting, important, very precious relationships. And that's also, those are the sorts of moments that we're trying to help foster, really.
Sure, I love that. And you've really reminded me of the experience a few of my friends have shared of having been sectioned. The kind of camaraderie they can feel on the ward, that you're all there to get better, it's a shared goal. And I think the patients that are doing a bit better and have good self-awareness in terms of their recovery, I think can really feel how, when you're in that closed environment, you can all influence each other. So there is a shared goal of not only all recovering, but also keeping morale up. And getting along.
Definitely, it makes such a difference to have a sort of feeling of community, and having items that can bring that communal feeling together is so important to us. It makes such a difference, and it's reflected in what the young people ask for, that they want that feeling as well. So we as a charity are so interested and desperate to have lived experience at the heart of what we do. So mm-hmm. we ask every ward that we work with to collaboratively make a list between staff and patients. We recognise that there are going to be barriers to that depending on how well people are, how much people are feeling like they want to engage. But as much as possible, we want the young people, children and young people on the wards, to come up with that list and come up with what they would like. And the stuff that they put on the wards is exactly what I and my peers would have put on there. It's games, it's DVDs, it's things to do together, because it makes you make friends on the ward. It becomes normal. You're still a young person. You still, you know, have friendship groups, get to know each other, like have a laugh, have a good time. And when you've got actually nice things to do that with, when you've got games that you can play that are new, that you can talk about, that they might bring someone new in that maybe you haven't talked to, maybe someone who's more unwell can come and join in something. And you can also make relationships with staff. I think often people don't see staff as quite a separate entity, but you can have good relationships with staff, and providing things that can create and foster those relationships is so important to us, because that's what makes, I have good memories of being in hospital. I've made friends that I'm still friends with now, and this is when I was 14, 15, 16, 17, and I've got friends that I still am really, really close to now from being in hospital, and I have happy memories of bouncing on space hoppers down the corridor of one of the wards, racing office chairs with staff as well, staff and patients, having these really fun times, playing really fun daft party game with one of the staff members. It's making those connections and having that sense of community is so important in recovery, because it stops that feeling of isolation. And it's never not going to be, you're never not going to be in hospital. But if we can make it a little bit better, if we can enhance that experience and make someone's time there, even just have create a couple of good memories, then I feel like we're really achieving what we've set out to do. We're not trying to be saviours at all.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And what's the reaction been like from the patients themselves?
We have in the past had really beautiful cards written by the young people to say, thank you very much, this has made a real difference. The staff members tell us that they've made a difference and what the young people have really enjoyed. We tend to get a lot of feedback about things like, we sometimes give Lush products, so really nice kind of shower bombs, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. just because they feel decadent and luxurious, but also they're very different to the sort of thing you might have in hospital generally. So it really helps you feel like you're, well, it might help you feel like you're a bit somewhere else for a little bit of escapism and decadence for a brief moment. So we tend to get a lot of feedback about that. But the feedback we've had so far has been wonderful. We had some really nice feedback actually from a parent on Twitter recently, which is lovely, because we hadn't really thought about what it means for parents too. Because I think for me, myself, having visited a loved one in hospital, you don't want to be asking them the same questions over and over again. How are you? How's your meds? What did you eat today? How are you feeling? Because that can feel horrible, having to talk about your mental health over and over and over again. But it does feel nice to be able to say, oh, what did you sing on the karaoke machine last night? What have you been up to? We've had a few parents mentioning that it's really nice to have something for their child to look forward to, but also for them to look forward to together.
Yeah, we had a nurse tell us that we, one of the wards we worked on, that the patients who were there on Christmas Day were using the new games that we bought them. And it's so sad to be there on Christmas Day, but they had some games they could play with their parents, and that they were able to have fun and have a good time playing these new games. And it's really important to us to give stuff that's new, that's branded, that feels like a treat, because it'd be really easy to get the money that we've got and just spend it all on getting quantity, as much quantity, mm-hmm. a bigger quantity of stuff as possible. But you sort of ask yourself, if you're giving a gift to a loved one, you don't get them the cheapest possible item and give them loads of it. You get them something that feels nice and like a treat. And so when we give something, we give them games that they actually want, stuff they've asked for, and we try and get, you know, the good quality stuff. So they feel like, yeah, this is nice. This is good stuff to have on the ward. We matter. Our voice is being listened to. They've got what we asked for, and they haven't just got us the cheapest one. They've got us a decent one. It's going to last. We're going to make the most of it. And it means that they're able to feel proud of the stuff that they've got on the ward as well. And yeah, share it with their parents, which is stuff we really didn't think about. Like Jazz said, we didn't think about the impact it would have on parents either.
And actually, the quality of the things is something we get feedback on quite a bit. People say, oh, it's actually really nice stuff. And I guess if you're used to self-stigma, or you're feeling confused or isolated, or any of those feelings that naturally might come with a stay in hospital, feeling like you're worthy of something special, valuable and important is something that we really want to foster and really demonstrate that, you know, you're worthy of those things.
And something that one of our friends raised with us, which I hadn't, you know, in my privileged position, hadn't thought about, was that there are lots of people from the care system who are in hospital. And so she spoke about how much it would have meant to her to have sort of good quality stuff and to have things brought in specifically for them and to have things to do on the ward when she might not get to really spend time with family, having come from the care system.
You're quite right. There is a overrepresentative group of people from the care system in these kind of environments. And it's so lovely to hear that that's the kind of response that you've had, and that people appreciate the humanising effect of these personalised quality gifts. It must be very empowering for the patients to feel that they matter and that as cut off from the rest of the world as they can feel, that there are people on the outside that care, that strangers are willing to put in money to make sure they have an easier Christmas, I think is incredibly heartwarming.
We've had a lot of comments on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook as well from people who haven't been children or young people in the hospitals that we've worked with, but have been in hospital themselves, and who've said, actually, if this had existed when I'd been in hospital, it's something that I really would have benefited from. So we really, really value when people get in touch with us, because it's really important, as Katie said, it's really important that we have those experiences at the heart of what we do. And obviously no two experiences are the same. So the more we hear from people about what that experience is like, the better for us, really.
For sure. Absolutely. So we'll start rounding up in a minute. Is there anything else you wanted to share?
Just that we're all year round, really. So Christmas is here and it's such an important time for us to get our boxes in and to get people feeling included. But in some ways it's easier for us to raise money at Christmas. People are feeling more generous, people are feeling more up for giving, which is wonderful and we're so grateful. But it's not just Christmas. Young children, young people are in hospital all year round. That's why we also work at Easter and in the summer holidays. So we're really keen to keep interest up in for the whole year, and we'll be hoping to get as much help as possible over the next year, over the next, you know, the whole time that we're doing what we're doing. We really want people to stay involved and stay listening all year round. And the help that we get all year round makes such a difference.
And we're also listening. So we're always pleased when people get in touch with us. If people do want to get in touch with us and tell us what hospital has been like for them, what would have helped, we're always really grateful to hear from them.
For sure, that's great to hear. And so if people want to find out more about Deck the Wards, where should they go online?
Well, we have a website, deckthewards.co.uk. We're also on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We try to post as regularly as possible, but between the three of us as a small charity, it's something we're hoping to improve on in the new year. But those are the best ways to get hold of us, really.
Please do, on any of those mediums. We're so happy to hear from anyone. We're so happy to be able to get people's messages across. People who don't have any experience of mental health, who just want to say, look, actually, I hadn't thought about this. That's really helpful for us to hear as well. So please contact us on any network.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been great chatting.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.